basis by the church, by local churches, and there were certain qualifications that that were laid out that she had to have met in order for the church to do that. And one principle that's listed there is that the responsibility that people have for care of their own, family. And it's a big responsibility, one that seems to be being forgotten about in our society today. There seems to be almost no obligation on the part of some to help their parents. And it's a shame. And it impresses upon us not just an honor from the standpoint of respect, but also from the standpoint of financial responsibility we have towards our own, in particular the real estate that are listed. The point we also made, though, about a little bit that last time was that the point the church should not be charged with the responsibility of caring for those widows if she did not meet those qualifications. It's very restrictive. And it just seems odd that many today would charge the local church with all kinds of responsibilities in terms of use of their money, building schools, building recreational facilities, all sorts of things they do with their money, and yet very strict things are listed here, even to help a widow of all people. I think there's a point that we should consider when you think about what the church is to do with its funds. And the Bible is very restrictive in that standpoint. And I think it's a significant point in that context. Anyway, we won't belabor that point. Let's go on into 1 Timothy 5. We're going to turn our attention now from widows to elders, treatment of elders. Let's read the passage. It's not very long. We're going to be reading from 17 through the end of the chapter. And I'm reading from the English Standard Version. I use the New American Standard quite a bit, but more this time in studying, so we may get both of those as well as other versions. Verse 17, let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in preaching and teaching. For the Scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain, and the laborer deserves his wages. Do not admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. As for those who persist in sin, rebuke them in the presence of all, so that the rest may stand in fear. In the presence of God, and of Christ Jesus, and of the elect angels, I charge you to keep these rules without prejudging, doing nothing from partiality. Do not be hasty in the laying on of hands, nor take part in the sins of others. Keep yourself pure. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. The sins of some people are conspicuous, going before them to judgment, but the sins of others appear later. So also good works are conspicuous, and even those that are not cannot be hidden. Let's go back up to verse 17. The elders who rule well be considered worthy of double honor. Now, the word for elder here is the word that we noticed in a previous class, presbyteros, which in and of itself just meant older men, but the Bible took it and applied it in a special way to this particular office and overseer. As is the case with many words, many of our words, the meaning of a word is dictated by the context in which it's used. And I think it's obvious from this context, this is talking about someone who's serving in an official capacity as an overseer or a bishop of the congregation. The word here for rule is from a Greek word, and I'm not going to attempt to pronounce all these Greek words, because if I did pronounce them, it probably would be wrong. It means to be over, or to superintend, to preside over. So you can see elders ruling over gives us the sense that this is an elder who is in official capacity as an elder. Now the word for honor here, and I didn't get the Greek word, but there was a word there that was associated with it, has to do it with a valuing, connected with a price pay or preciousness, price or sum. So again, that kind of goes back to that argument we made previously with respect to the word honor. It carries with it the idea of financial remuneration, financial worth, financial value. And as we noticed here, in fact, the point I've got there about verse 18, it'll be developed a little bit more in verse 18. We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. So again, the elders who rule well are worthy of double honor. Again, not just respect, but again, there's a financial prospect here associated with that. And I believe that's the idea, part of the idea that's being developed here by Paul. Especially those, I'm going to go over now to the next chart. It helps if you turn it on. It's on. Do I hear it buzz? Somebody can probably do it. The word here for labor is from a Greek word. It means grow weary, tired, exhausted, to toil. So we have elders here who are literally spending a lot of time, effort, and energy associated with this office. The word here for labor, those who labor in word or doctrine, the word for doctrine implies the act of teaching, preaching and teaching. And when he says especially those, he's emphasizing that there are certain elders who may serve in the capacity of being preachers or spending a lot of time, all their time, teaching. And one commentator even made the point that some elders might serve in a part-time capacity in terms of their work. They may have secular jobs, is what I'm trying to say, work outside not just the church, but there would be some who might be devoted completely as on a full-time basis to working with the church. And I believe that's kind of the idea that's being developed here, especially those who labor in word and doctrine. That is, in fact, the New American Standard actually uses the word preaching and teaching here. So this is the idea of an elder, I think, that preaches, or could qualify in that capacity. It's odd to me that some churches resist that, resist having an elder serve as an overseer when it seems to be what Paul's talking about. At least that would be included in what Paul's talking about. Any comment, anybody, any point anybody has to make there? No, I'm kind of rolling through. I hadn't thought about that. Darren points out that maybe some would be primarily associated with preaching and teaching. Maybe others would have a focus on some other things. We do know that one of the qualifications that we noticed earlier was apt to teach. So I would think, at least in some capacity, they would be involved in teaching or at least have that responsibility. But I hadn't really thought about that. That's an interesting way to think about it. It does seem to make a distinction here between an elder who labors in word and doctrine and is saying especially those. So that implies, when he says especially those, that implies there's something that would maybe not be as involved in that aspect. So you may really be onto something there. I haven't thought about that. It's a good point. Somebody else? Okay. This is what I was talking about a minute ago, the idea of the financial remuneration, the financial responsibility, or financial, I won't say responsibility necessarily, but the idea of paying an elder, I think is really developed in verse 18. Now, this is a quote from Deuteronomy, the 25th chapter. This was a quote from the law that basically said, don't muzzle an ox while he treads out the grain. So what was the point of that? Huh? It is, and we'll notice 1 Corinthians here in a minute, that definitely ties that. I meant going back all the way to the law. What was the point that was being made there? I think it was just fairness to the animal. The animal is participating in the work of treading out the grain. Don't put a muzzle on the animal and keep him from eating while he's working. He should benefit from the very work that he's involved in. I mean, God even had a sense of fairness to animals. But we see, as we go a little further, it's quoted by Paul. Let's just turn over to 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter. You know, it's the first time I've used this little thing here. I kind of like this. The only thing I don't like about it is true of anywhere I go is a glare on the screen. But anyway, 1 Corinthians 9. And it'd be better if it was on my left hand. I'm left-handed. But I'm not saying change it anyway. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 9. For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak of it for our sake? It was written in for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. For if we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share in this rightful claim on you, do we not even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right. And again, this is Paul saying, I could have taken wages from you, but I didn't. But we endure anything rather than put on an obstacle in the way in the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple? and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings. In the same way, the Lord commanded those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. So here we learn that God endorses the idea of paying a preacher. Right? That's why we have the authority to pay Steve a salary, because he works here among us. He labors and preaches and teaches for us. And just as Paul had that ability to accept this from the Corinthian brethren, so we do that today with respect to paying our preachers. This is in the very verse that's used here. It goes back to the old law that says, you shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. You know, back then, God knew, when he gave that law of Moses, he knew that one day he was going to use that as a point later on to make this very point we're making tonight. And that idea is developed now to show that not only is a preacher entitled to receive wages from preaching, elders are as well. Yeah, I thought about that verse. Now, obviously the context here is about paying the elders and preachers, but it goes back. Buford points out, was it Proverbs 12 and verse 10, a righteous man regards the life of his animals. And I thought about that verse, not just in this context, but in others, just thinking about it before. We're not to mistreat animals. A righteous man won't do that. Well, God, even back then, was concerned about animals, so concerned about the fair treatment of the animal. But again, he uses that particular thing to develop the idea that someone who labors in word and doctrine, preaching and teaching, can expect and is entitled to being financially supported as a result. And that not only applies to preachers, but it also applies to elders if they so chose. Again, maybe our elders don't do that, don't avail themselves of that, but I think they could. And the laborer is worthy of his wages. Let's talk about that for a moment. Now that idea advance my chart here. This is used by Jesus in Matthew the 10th chapter. We won't go back and read those. In the limited commission and the commission of the sending of the 70s, he mentions this as well. The laborer is worthy of his wages. Accept what is put before you. You're allowed to eat as you go and preach and teach. If someone brings you into your house, you're to eat what's put before you. Again, this is the idea of being supported while they're doing the work of Christ. And he uses that, again, that verse as well, and he ties that in here with this idea of supporting elders. So I think that's really clear. I don't think anybody has a question about that, but to me, I don't think that's that hard to see there. I believe that's exactly what he's trying to teach and preach to us. Let me get my charts where I can see them. I got my fonts big enough. I was told I had too small a fonts last time, and they were too small, so I made an effort to make sure they were large. So I haven't had to turn around because I can kind of make them out back here. So when I compare it to what I have here to what there, I know where I am. I really can't read it. Well, maybe I can. Kind of like doing an eye test. All right, let's move on. Well, another point we want to make here, it's an interesting point to think about. Paul quotes these passages in Luke and Matthew and applies them to the context of elders. We mentioned that. It also shows that Matthew and or Luke were probably already familiar to the readers. And Paul was aware of those passages and quoted them. Of course, he's doing it by inspiration. Another thing to consider, too, is look over to 1 Peter, the 9th chapter. I thought this was an interesting point to kind of bring into this to further support this idea. 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter. Now, this is an exhortation to elders. If you look at verse 1, I exhort the elders among you. Verse 2, shepherd the flock that is among you. Again, there's this idea of shepherding. Some of those same words we pointed out when we studied the role of elders and the usage of the different terms that's applied to elders. Shepherd the flock of God, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly. And I want you to notice something in particular. Not for shameful or sordid, as some versions say, gain. And financial benefits was not to be a motivational type of thing for an elder, even though we're pointing out from these verses that he would be entitled to that, he should not go into that office seeking that as a means of just gaining money. And I think that's the point that Peter is making here. And to me, it ties that in, ties this whole concept in, that's something the elders would be entitled to. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting point to make as well. All right. I got 20-something charts, but, you know, I have big fonts, so there's not a lot on each one. I'm going to get my Bible back at 1 Timothy. All right. Now we're moving on a little bit about with respect to the receiving an accusation against an elder. Verse 19, it says that an accusation against the elders should be supported by two or three witnesses. And this was a requirement of the law of Moses. When someone brought charges, it would have to have been supported by two or three witnesses, not just a single witness. And if you go back, look back to Matthew, the 18th chapter. It was an interesting point made. Now, this has to do with one brother sinning against another brother, but there's something that Jesus brings out with respect to this that ties in and harmonizes with what's just said about the elders. Your brother sins against you, I'm in verse 15. Go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother. If he does not listen, take one or two others along with you, that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. Again, same idea, two or three witnesses. Keep going here. So, this principle is referred to quite a bit, really more than I had realized. The idea of for testimony to be valid, it required two or three witnesses. Jesus actually used that to bear witness of himself. And the charge was, well, you bear witness of yourself, your testimony is not true, or your testimony is not valid. And he says, I testify of myself, and the Father testifies of me. There in John, which this is an aside, but that pretty much destroys the theory that the Godhead, all parts being one, and there not being a difference between God the Father, God the Holy Spirit, God the Son. I don't see how Jesus could make that point if that were true. Anyway, that's not relevant to what we're studying tonight, but I thought that was an interesting point to make. Paul uses it in 2 Corinthians, the 13th chapter. Let's look over to there. Verse 1. This is the third time I'm coming to you. Every charge must be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. The Hebrew writer also makes mention of it as well in Hebrews, the 10th chapter. Hebrews 10:28. Anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. Again, two or three witnesses. I think we see this principle as in effect for all people, but it's especially true in the case of elders who are accused, because I think he's pointing that out, Timothy, because elders, by virtue of the fact of the position that they serve in, are sometimes susceptible to scrutiny. They're susceptible to public scrutiny by others. And for one to bring a charge against an elder definitely requires this idea of two or three witnesses, is the point that he's making. And that's something that we should make sure that we follow. If we have a problem with something an elder is doing, we should be able to... Now, I do believe the principle that Jesus said in Matthew 18 is still applied. In fact, I think that's one of the points on one of my subsequent charts. If it's between two people, one of which would be an elder, I think we have a responsibility to go along, like Jesus said. But in terms of something that's publicly done, I believe that it's saying that should be substantiated by two or three witnesses. Any point anybody has to make? Either y'all are really agreeing with me on everything, or you're tired from a long day. Yeah, I mean, this is something that's a sinful, sin type thing. I don't think it just means a personal preference. And I don't like the way they did that. You know, everybody could quit. And no matter what you do, you're not going to satisfy everybody. And that's true of not just elders. That's true of anything, in any situation. But this would be involved in sin. And I think the verses will bear that out as we keep going here. So verse 20. Those who continue in sin, and again, according with what Wayne just said, rebuke in the presence of all, so that the rest also will be fearful of sinning. Now, who is he writing this to? Writing it to a young preacher named Timothy, who's going to be working with churches. So he's giving him instruction, all this book, giving him various instructions for how to act and how to do things in terms of his work with local churches, right? So he would have a responsibility to kind of lead that, it seems to me. If there's an elder there who is sinning and that sin is known and it's substantiated, he would have a responsibility to rebuke before all so that others would see that and realize that, you know, I should not sin either because I'm going to be rebuked publicly if I do that. It's a detriment, or it's a deterrent, excuse me, for others to sin. You know, when Peter sinned, what was Peter's sin in Galatians that's mentioned? Yeah, he showed partiality because he had been eating with Gentiles, but before some of the other Jews came, before some of the other Jews came there into the town where he was located, he would eat with Gentiles and everything seemed fine. Well, when certain Jews came, he separated himself and refused to eat with them and was very hypocritical in that aspect. And even Barnabas got caught up in it and was influenced to do the same thing. What does it say Paul did with respect to confronting Peter? He rebuked him. He did what? Yeah, withstood him to the face. Withstood him to the face. You know, I think Peter's a lot like a lot of us. Good thing about Peter, did he just quit and run off and give up on God? No. We see later on that he refers to Paul as beloved brother Paul. So he took that. And apparently took that well. And apparently that was done in a way that Paul was very upfront with him about it. So we see Paul following this principle as well. He confronted him over it. As we've just noticed, this public review would serve as a deterrent. And again, the point I made a few minutes ago, I do believe that if it's between two brothers, one of which would be an elder, I think that the instruction that Jesus gave with respect to dealing with sin on a private matter and a private basis would still apply. The person who'd been offended would have the responsibility to go to the elder and deal with him. But even then it says, if you won't hear, then you establish everything by two or three witnesses. So we see that falling into place there and harmonizing. Any point anybody would like to make? I have never heard that. I don't know where they would get that. No, I know you're not saying it. Yeah. Darren, for those of you who couldn't hear, Darren points out some people take verse 19 to mean that the accusation against the elder must come through the preacher. And that's something I've never considered or thought about. And it doesn't sound like it makes a lot of sense to me. Again, without having thought about it anymore beyond that, I'm cautious to say much, but it doesn't seem to jive with a lot of other passages. Right. I have never heard that. I guess without studying anymore, part of me wants to say that this has more to do with the idea that, Timothy was set apart for a special work with respect to this time frame and, his assistance with churches that had been established in a special way by Paul under an apostle, and that he would have some, again, this would be in the days and age when the Bible wasn't completely revealed. Again, I'm probably saying more than I should, because I haven't really studied it that well. I don't believe that it's teaching that, but something I want to look at. I would think they would be. In my way of thinking, and again, this is just me, I would think they would have to be. They're there to corroborate the charge. To me, if you go back to the old law, it's used the same way. That's what I'm thinking. But again, that's the one I probably need to study some more. Mr. Stevens? You don't have a lot of time for me to go into a lot of it. I understand the points that you're making. I guess I take these verses, the verses we mentioned a minute ago, to me to include an elder who preaches. Now, I don't know if he would necessarily have to be in serving as an elder preacher. We can study it some more, and I certainly respect your viewpoint. And I do know that people abuse those denominational world would definitely abuse that. I don't think necessarily that the abuse by some would necessarily negate the right. But I'll go back and look at it some more. Anyway, I do respect your review for that. Yes, sir. Yeah, and that's a pretty, the Bible does say that if we charge someone with something, we're to have it with two or three witnesses. Again, after we've tried to deal with it in a private way, if it's a private matter between two people. So, one commentator I read, this would be someone that would agree with us, I think it was Marshall Patton, some of you would know who that was, and I used his commentary a good bit of this, talked about how people don't follow that. So those are good points. Tell you what, we're going to have to get to this point about Timothy's about using wine for your stomach's sake. We don't have a lot of time, so we're going to move on. There's good, very good comments from everybody that I really do appreciate. I've lost my place. Oh, okay, verse 21, thank you. I solemnly charge you in the presence of God, of Christ Jesus, and of His chosen angels, maintain these principles without bias, without doing anything in a sense of partiality. When he says the idea here of, I'm going to move on a little bit, basically he's charging him very solemnly before three classes of your God, Jesus, and of the angels. These would be messengers of God. The word for angel that's used in the Bible can refer to just a general messenger, or it can refer to an angelic celestial being. And the context seems to indicate here that this is in the presence of select angels. How they were selected, we don't know, but it does use that term. And he says to do it without prejudice. Don't prejudge without having all the facts. And it sort of kind of gets into the same idea here, being a sense of fairness when you see the accusation. Don't do it with partiality. Partiality would be kind of favoring one person for whatever reason. Maybe you're friends with them or close to them. You know, don't let that influence you in doing what's right. And that's what the point that we kind of summarize there at the very bottom of the chart. Don't prejudge a matter or an individual without having all the facts. Don't let your personal feelings influence you in doing what's right and carrying out discipline. Laying on of hands. Don't lay on hands on anyone too hastily. Now, through the years when I've read that verse, I thought, don't grab somebody and mishandle them the wrong way, you know, too quick. But I don't believe that's what that's talking about. What's the subject matter that we're talking about in this little stretch here? What class of people? Treatment of elders. And I think that's what he's continuing to say. We have several verses here that point out the idea of laying on of hands was a special way of pointing someone to a position or to a particular function. We see that in Acts 6, those men who were chosen to serve the Grecian widows. We see it used by the apostles to impart spiritual gifts in Acts 8. When Saul and Barnabas, who were selected for their work by the Holy Spirit, the elders laid their hands on them there. The gift that Timothy received, the Bible makes the point, you receive that by the laying on of the hands of the elders. And I didn't realize this until I studied this and saw it in a commentary, that it's actually listed among the foundational elementary principles that are listed in Hebrews the 6th chapter. The laying on of hands is listed among those. So I think what it's really talking about, since it's in the context about elders, is basically saying exercise caution and carefulness in selecting a man to this office. Exercise caution and careful, probably with respect to receiving a charge as well, but since the idea of laying on hands had to do with setting them apart or consecrating them for a particular work, in this case the eldership, he's saying be careful about that, is the point that he's making. Keep yourself free from sin, he says. So basically, if you were to involve yourself in appointing a man who was a known sinner to the office of elder, you would share or participate in that sin by endorsing what he is doing. Now, probably the one you've all been waiting on right here, right? 1 Timothy 5:23, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake. The idea of only drinking, depends on the version that you read. King James may lead you to believe that he means that if you took it literally, the way that seems to be written, well, don't drink any water at all, but that's really not the way that it's worded in the Greek. It means don't drink water only. Most of the newer versions will actually put it that way. New American Standard, I believe it is, says no longer drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake. Now, some suggest that this is mixing wine with water would purify the water. I tell you what, you start reading on this subject and you'll find just about, you'll run the gamut of opinions. And I found one that basically said there's not a lot of scientific evidence to suggest that that's really that works. Let's talk about this word wine. I'm kind of rushing because we're running out of time. It's from that common word that was often translated wine in the New Testament, oinos or onos. That's a broad term. It can refer to fruit of the vine and the grape itself, or juice in the grape, freshly squeezed, all the way up to fermented wine. And that's a lot of people in the world don't realize that that's the way it's used in the Bible. And the context has to help us understand exactly, is it fermented, is it non-fermented? And we'll talk about some arguments pro and con from that. It also included a non-alcoholic syrup that was basically you take grape juice and you cook it down, and it could be used, it could be stored that way and for later use. It would be non-alcoholic, and you could actually take it and add water to it and reconstitute it. And it was used for that beverage as well. I think I read something like that. Right. Mr. Stevens points out that a lot of Roman soldiers would have taken that reconstituted type of syrup, and since they didn't have a means of refrigeration, it would have been preserved by having been boiled down into that syrup, and they could take water and reconstitute it as they went from place to place. So that definitely would have been included in this kind of thing. But again, the context helps us understand whether or not it's fermented versus non-fermented. Now, he prescribes it as a use for a medicinal purpose, and we know, even today, you travel in a country, particularly a third world country, you have to be very careful about the water. I've been places where I was told, don't drink the water. It's okay to brush your teeth with it, but don't drink it. I know some places, I haven't been to anything place like this, some places they say don't even brush your teeth with it. So water has long been known to be associated with stomach ailments and other illnesses. What I tried to do is list arguments on both sides of whether or not this was fermented or unfermented. I think in the grander scheme of things, it really doesn't matter because we're talking about a medicinal purpose. He points out to him, don't drink exclusively water. So that suggests Timothy had a conscience about drinking wine. However it was used, fermented or non-fermented, he had a problem with it. It implied he had a conscience because he had to be told, don't keep from drinking it anymore. So, you know, why would he avoid the use of plain grape juice? To me, that would be a question I would ask. If you contend that he's saying this is grape juice, why would Timothy have a problem with drinking grape juice in the first place? Here's another argument or two. He says use a little wine. Why limit grape juice? And we've already seen the term wine having been used with respect to the qualifications for elders and deacons, and that context indicated that would be alcoholic. Not given to wine, not given to much wine, suggests, again, wouldn't make a lot of sense to say not given to grape juice. Oh, okay. You mean, oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that. It's a purpose. It's a use a little water. I hadn't thought about that. When basically say, when you say use a little water, that means you are, there's a purpose behind your use of it. So I hadn't thought about that. So let's look at some arguments, supporting that it's unfermented. Pliny, who was a ancient naturalist and writer, he describes a certain type of unfermented wine that resulted from filtering fresh grape juice where basically the yeast products are strained out, and when you take sugar and yeast to make wine, to make alcohol, to result in the fermenting process. If you don't have either one, you're not going to have alcohol. And when one is used up, the alcohol production stops. So that's how wine is made essentially. So what they would do, they would actually filter it really, really well. You could filter out the yeast and you'd be left with a very fresh grape juice product. And that was something that was used, and that's something that was done back then. There are two terms that are used to describe used by ancient sources to describe unfermented wines that are given to sick people. One is actually called a stomach wine. And it was prepared from that thick syrup that we mentioned a minute ago. And it was given specifically to help people who had digestive problems. So there were things out there described as stomach wine that would have been known to that world back then. And some people contend that that is what Paul is referring to. Again, I personally think the arguments are better to suggest that this was a fermented product. But the point we want to make here is, even if it was a fermented product, this passage only authorizes its use for one, as a medicine, and two, it limits it to a little amount. And there's nothing in this passage that indicates that this should be used to induce any kind of intoxicating effect. It was basically just a remedy for stomach ailments or other ailments. So again, I think it is talking about fermented wine. But even then, there's nothing in this passage that suggests us go out and have a drink. It's safe to have a drink. It's a medicinal purpose. Any comment? We're just about out of time. I want to hit these last couple of verses here. It says that the sins of some are easily observed, while the sins of others will be revealed at the judgment. And that ties in with some other verses, and we won't read those, but basically God will bring everything into judgment. There may be things that people have in their personal lives that nobody knows about, but God knows about, and God will reveal them at judgment. Some things are more evident. And similarly, verse 25, in a parallel way, there are things that people do that are well, people that do things that are very good, that can't be hidden as well. And again, I think since we're talking about elders, and I know he kind of interjected that little comment about taking wine for your stomach's sake, it seems to me that this is in the greater context of dealing with elders as well. But that principle would still remain true because we have other passages to get back to. I talked real fast, and I'm sorry, I had a lot of charts. I hope I covered it properly and we all benefited from it. Appreciate all the good comments tonight. Thank you.